Good Monday morning and welcome to Jump in Tucson. I am your host, Dr. Ed Ackerley. With me in studio is my assistant, my executive assistant, Morgan Murphy. Good morning.
Good morning, Dr. Ackerley.
And we're just getting ready for another semester of Marketing Master Program.
Yes, at the University, my last semester.
Eller College. And we're wishing you so much luck as you finish up. And we appreciate all you're doing for Jump in Tucson and for Ackerley Advertising. With us, this is the Monday version of Jump in Tucson, where we talk about the wonderful things happening at the University of Arizona. Of course, wonder is the theme of the marketing campaign that Jenna Rushman and the Marcom people at the U of A have come up with. Tim Reister out of Phoenix came up with this idea of wonder about all the good things that are going on at the University of Arizona. And so we call this segment Wonder, where we talk about the good things going on at the university in research and in student outcomes and in all the things that are really important to the city of Tucson and by some stretch, to the world. So with us, my guests this morning are Stephen Cohen. Dr. Stephen Cohen, good morning.
Good morning.
And Dr. Abby Viswanath, good morning to you.
Good morning.
Did I do that right?
Thank you for having us. Yeah.
Is that close enough? Okay. Mm-hmm. So you guys are recently did some research and an article came out in Brain Magazine. We'll talk about that in just a second. But Abby, let's start with you. What's your educational journey and what brought you to the University of Arizona?
Yeah, so I came to the United States for my undergraduate degree in Tennessee. So I was at Tennessee State University doing being a psychology major, and I wanted to pursue research more, and I wanted to get into a PhD program, and U of A and Dr. Cowan seemed like the best fit for me.
That's excellent.
And the sunshine was hard to beat.
So you came here just for the doctorate then, or did you?
Yep. Okay. Yeah, so I came here in 2019.
Been here for 5 years doing postdoctoral research now. And congratulations on your doctorate, by the way.
Thank you.
That's great that you got that. And Dr. Cohen, let's talk a little bit about you. What is your educational journey, and how did you get to the University of Arizona?
Great. So I'm originally from Wisconsin, rural Wisconsin. Got a business degree from Wisconsin-Madison.
Oh, great.
Realized that wasn't...
Welcome to the club.
Yeah, all right. But then I kind of reflected back on my life and in high school. I was always interested in science, and so I knew I needed a break to kind of reconfigure where I wanted to go. So I wanted to help out. So I joined the Peace Corps, went to Honduras, volunteered there for about 2 years, and then realized that I needed to jump back into my interest in science. And so then I did a lot of background work and got myself prepared for graduate school, and then ended up in Tucson as a graduate student.
So what, you're at the University of Arizona now, what is your department, what department do you work out of mainly as you work on this research that you're doing?
So I'm in the psychology department.
Okay. Takes a brainiac to work in the psychology department, right? And so you're out of psychology as well then?
Yeah.
Okay, fantastic. So there was a recent findings published in Brain Magazine, but also Brain Journal, I guess it should be called, and obviously it was on UA News talking about groundbreaking study on Parkinson's disease. So, Dr. Cohen, let's start with you and just tell us, for the casual person, we all know probably people that, celebrities and so forth, or maybe people in our family or in our inner circle that have been afflicted with Parkinson's disease. Can you just kind of give a layman's approach to what Parkinson's disease is and how it affects a human?
Right. So it usually happens when you get older with this particular disease, in that there are certain types of neurons in the brain, dopamine neurons and some other types of neurons, that gradually die with the disease. And those are the neurons, these particular dopamine neurons, are very important for controlling our movement. And when those neurons stop producing dopamine, movements slow, you have difficulty initiating movements also, and difficulty speaking and other issues progress at the early movement stage. And then later on, things can progress to more cognitive issues as well.
Right. And I would say, you know, again, from the layman's perspective, that one of the ways that those of us that don't know a lot about the brain and what's going on and so forth, one of the ways that the disease manifests itself for those onlookers is the shaking, and the hand shaking basically is where you kind of see that
tremor.
And that's kind of, when you see somebody with that, you kind of make this, it may or may not be Parkinson's, but that's kind of what you would first think of, is, oh, maybe that person has Parkinson's disease. And And so that's a brain situation with neurons and dopamine and so forth. And as you age, that dopamine doesn't make the neurons fire like they're supposed to, basically.
Exactly.
Right. Yeah. And you had talked about how in the recent article or when you were trying to explain it, you kind of said that when these neurons are firing, if they start firing intermittently without anybody, without any coordination, it's, I thought this was a great analogy. It's like having an orchestra with a director gone on vacation and everyone's playing some notes and so forth, but it's not all coordinated in the right thing. So that's a good analogy for people as to why this is. So tell me a little bit about dopamine. What is dopamine and how do we make it in our brains and so forth? I don't know how we make it, but it's there in our brains. And what is dopamine?
Yeah, you could think about it as a chemical that's released in the brain. Most people know it as the good emotion or the one that makes you feel good, things like that.
Give me more of that dopamine. Yeah.
Right, yeah.
They've written songs about that, I think. Yeah.
But the lesser known is like it's important role in movement. It actually release of dopamine in certain brain regions helps you start movements and helps you keep movements going on. So with the decline in dopamine, that's when this added effect in movement disorders come in.
Right.
These patients also have affective changes as well, where their emotions are also stunted a little bit. So it has this two kind of roles in the brain, mostly.
So I'm watching you as you speak to me. Of course, this is radio and people can't see what I'm saying, but you're actually talking to me with your hands and your brain is, you know, without you consciously knowing this, your brain, I'm doing it right now myself, your brain is allowing movement to take place and the dopamine is probably helping with that. And it's not scripted or anything per se, but it's coordinated.
Mm-hmm.
And that coordination comes about through the brain being able to control all of that while having you think and speak at the same time. So we kind of take it for granted of what dopamine and what the brain does, but it's an amazing array of millions of neurons that are firing on a regular basis.
Billions.
Yeah.
And so just the study of the brain alone is like being an astronomer. There are just more and more discoveries happening. I think at one time, one of the presidential candidates talked about having a space shot of, exploring the oceans and exploring the heavens and then trying to, but we need to do the same thing with the brain. So, well, when we come back after the break, we'll talk about this research and what the exciting new things about ketamine and some other things that you've talked about in this article. You're listening to Jump in Tucson. We're talking with Dr. Stephen Cohen and Dr. Abby Vishwanath, a postdoctoral research associate in the College of Psychology at the Psychology, is that what we said?
Department of Psychology Department and the College of Science.
Department of Psychology and the College of Science. You're listening to Jump in Tucson. We'll be back after word from our beautiful, great sponsors. Welcome back to Jump in Tucson. This is the Monday Wonder Edition where we talk about the good things going on at the University of Arizona in science and outcomes and so forth. And a really interesting conversation going on with Dr. Stephen Cohen, who is in the College of Psychology the Department of Psychology in the College of Science at the University of Arizona. And welcome back.
Thank you.
And Dr. Abby Vishwanath, who is a postdoctoral research. Again, congratulations on your doctorate and moving forward with this exciting research.
Thank you.
So we're talking about Parkinson's disease and involuntary movement and how the brain works and what providers can do to help mitigate that those involuntary movements and so forth. So let's talk first about the gold standard or the standard that is to treat the Parkinson's with
levodopa.
And tell us a little bit about what that does.
Yeah, so Parkinson's disease, where there's a loss of dopamine, the logical step would be to replace that dopamine so that it helps people regain some of that control of movement. So that's done by the levodopa drug, which essentially produces more dopamine or leads to more production.
So as they take the levodor, is that what it's called?
Levodopa.
Levodopa, as they take that, eventually that's converted into, or the
dopamine.
Brain gets dopamine going, and that helps.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a problem with that over time, right? The brain gets sensitized to that?
Yeah, the brain learns essentially and adapts to the dopamine levels in the brain, and the receptor and parts of the brain that produce dopamine get changed, and as a result, the medicine itself causes huge problems.
Right. So the medicine that you're taking to solve the original problem over time might actually lead to more involuntary movement?
Yes. It's almost the opposite of Parkinson's disease, where instead of low, slow, and just very small movements, the dopamine replaced by this levodopa drug causes these huge ballistic movements that are uncontrollable.
Interesting. And so you were the lead author, and you had others help you with this, but a great postdoctoral research partner in this. And you discovered that ketamine aids in controlling this involuntary movement. So how does ketamine help control this? And you call it a double shot because it does two things for it. How does that help control this involuntary movement and help mitigate that effect of the original medicine in trying to get the dopamine to a level where controlling that involuntary movement?
Right. So what we think is going on is that we have a part of the brain called the motor cortex. It's on the top of your brain, and it's called motor cortex because we think it's very important for controlling our movements. And a general theory is that when dyskinesia, which is the disorder we have when you take levodopa over many years, that the problem with dyskinesia is that the motor cortex is sending bad signals to the muscles and you're causing these movements. Well, that our study is seeing that that's probably not the case, that in dyskinesia, it's like the motor cortex goes on vacation. It's not really controlling those downstream centers for movement anymore, and they're left to do whatever they want. And some of those things might be these large movements, dyskinetic movements that are being generated. What we think ketamine is at least partly doing is helping restore that connection so that motor cortex gains a little more control of those downstream movements to allow the person to, again, regain some control again of and still take some of that drug again, ideally, so that they can still treat the low dopamine in their brain.
You know, I often think about how do you discover to take ketamine to mitigate this thing? How did that ever come about? Because ketamine is like an antiseptic, right? It's used for a lot of different things, right? Mm-hmm. How did they discover that ketamine aids in this controlling of involuntary? How did that all I don't want to say experimental, but someone figured it out and you're doing the research on it. But how did that happen originally?
Right. I mean, yeah. I can't say, you want to go?
No.
Okay, well, so it wasn't us. We weren't the persons who really brought us into ketamine with dyskinesia. They're in the neurology department. Dr. Torsten Falk and Dr. Scott Sherman kind of started the ball rolling. And it might have, I don't know exactly the origin story, but I know how they roped me into it because I'm very interested in brain waves and brain oscillations, patterns of how neurons synchronize with one another. And they kind of told me, hey, ketamine causes all these interesting effects, so why don't you go ahead and look at it in the brain? And we gave ketamine, in this case, to rats, and it caused these incredibly strong, interesting patterns of brain waves. And so that was my hook. That's what got me started on this path.
Very interesting.
In your article, you talk about neuroplasticity and how that, you know, to understand that, or to understand Parkinson's, you have to understand neuroplasticity. Can you explain what that is?
Yep. So neuroplasticity is a way for newly formed connections to persist over time. So what ketamine comes in and does, Dr. Cowan was saying, is that it changes the state from dyskinesia to something else. But that can be easily switched back. But what ketamine does is this 1-2 punch where it initially changes it from dyskinesia to an altered state. But over time, it initiates these slower changes, slower processes that take place over hours or days, where they solidify or make the altered state occur more frequently than the dyskinetic state. So that's how the longer lasting change occurs in dyskinesia, and that's under the umbrella of like neuroplasticity changes, where these changes last over time and become more prevalent.
So when you take ketamine, then how quickly does it start to help control those that process? And then do you end up taking ketamine for a long time after that then, because you got to take them in concert with one another?
Well, our data speaks mostly to our studies with rats. So I can speak a lot about Parkinsonian rats. So, right. But the effects are, the one thing that was really exciting about ketamine is the effects are
immediate.
Oh, yeah. Wow. Minute. Obviously they're like,
that's pretty exciting. Being, yeah.
Observing these animals like moment to moment, and then you saw the reduction in dyskinesia. Like
2 minutes in, they stop making these dyskinetic movements when we give ketamine.
I go back to, I wonder how they thought of trying ketamine and seeing if that could help control, and the result of that has been pretty mind-boggling, as they say, since we're talking about the mind. We're talking with Dr. Stephen Cohen, the senior author, and Dr. Abhi Viswanath, who is a postdoctoral research and a new doctor, and working on Parkinson's and the brain and how the brain works and what you can do to control the effects of Parkinson's disease. So, we talk about this type of research. It requires funding, obviously, and so you got a grant for this this research. Who helped you with the research? Was it a federal grant to help you with this, or where did you get the grant money?
Yes, this money was very generously from taxpayers, from the National Institute of Health is one of our primary funders. There are other sources of support, but that was our main source of support.
This is really important to you as an investigator, and it's important that funds be made available. And of course, the University of Arizona is a Research One institution, and of course, the College of Science being, I think, the largest, if not the largest, one of the largest benefactors of grants from science foundations and the federal government and other places. That grant work is really important to getting these studies done, right?
Right, very much. In order so that Abhi has a salary and can
like
pay
that part,
rent,
don't we? Yeah.
You need to have to have your chemicals and instruments and lab space and rats and feed them.
Right.
Yeah, it requires a fair amount of money to make these research projects happen, and they take a long time. The data collection alone took almost 3 years.
4 years.
Four years.
Yeah. You counted every day, didn't you? Yeah.
That's
great. So what's the future of this research, and where do you go from here? Not that just because you published an article means that the study is over, but what do you hope to go in the future? What are you looking for in your postdoctoral research? What do you want to head next?
With the current research, we're trying to work on some more data analysis from the current data collected already. It's a mine. It's a lot of data to mine through.
Right.
But there's, in addition to the individual cells, there's also rhythms that appear over a large scale. We're trying to piece that apart and see what's different in dyskinesia and how does ketamine kind of bring that change about at that level. Going forward, we can also manipulate or turn cells on and off and try to see if there's a direct causal relationship to some of the things that we're seeing. So that's also something that Dr. Cowan's kind of working on, where we can turn particular cells on and off during dyskinesia and see if that kind of gives a similar effect of ketamine.
So you talked about this experiment being done in rats, and that's what you can speak to, but eventually this will go right away into human beings and to try and see if we can affect that on the human level, right?
Yeah, our other collaborators, Dr. Torsten Falk and Scott Sherman, they're working with others to get this investigated more in human subjects. They've already completed a phase one trial for safety for ketamine to be applied for treating dyskinesias, and they're working towards a phase two trial now. But that's where it's at. They'd better off speaking to the human application. But fortunately, ketamine is a relatively safe drug. For that.
Mark that down, Morgan. Let's get them on the show and talk about what their clinical trials and what they'll be
that'd
doing
be great.
In terms of Parkinson's. So,
that'd be awesome.
Well, we want to thank you both for being here this morning and sharing the wonder of the work that you do for the benefit of mankind at the University of Arizona, teaching students and having doctoral students who go on and become doctors. We want you to stay in Tucson now. We want you to stay here. So, Dr. Cohen, you got to get some good grant money and some other things to keep her here in Tucson. We want to keep bright young people in the old Pueblo. So you, that was a promise. She said she's not going anywhere.
It's an easy sell for staying in Tucson.
That's great. Yeah. Well, thank you both for coming. We appreciate what you do for the University of Arizona and providing wonder for the good things going on at the University of Arizona. We'll be back after the break with a second segment of Jump in Tucson. You're listening to KVOI, Tucson's live local news and talk. You're listening to Jump in Tucson. Welcome back to Jump in Tucson. This is the Monday Wonder Edition, where we talk about the good things going on at the University of Arizona. When you travel to New York or to Chicago and you hop in an Uber or a taxi and someone says, where are you from? You say, oh, well, I'm from Tucson, Arizona. And almost immediately they say, oh, the University of Arizona Wildcats. And one of those things is the athletic department at the U of A is well known, obviously, around the country and even around the world, especially our basketball program, which is international. And basketball is really important because it kind of is focuses on the University of Arizona in a unique way. And so we have to have an athletic department in order to have football games and 21 sports, I think there are now, at the intercollegiate level. And one of the people that helps manage that whole process is Mike Hairgrove, who is the Assistant Athletic Director of Athletic Facilities at the University of Arizona, McHale Center. Good morning, Mike. How are you?
Good, Ed. How are you?
Great, great. So tell us what the Assistant Athletic Director of Athletic Facilities at the University of Arizona does. What's your responsibility at the university?
Well, to start with, as you mentioned, the events that we have that go on for the actual 22 sports.
22 sports now.
Edition of women's triathlon.
Oh, that's right.
We actually had a successful second year here with winning their national championship. So, but we'll go back to your question. Sorry, I digressed a little bit. But it's basically a support role. It's making sure the coaches and staff have the things that they need and are in a working condition and are able to go. And so it varies from, you know, preparation for events, transitioning between events and practices, and then, like I said, helping with day-to-day stuff, getting offices ready for when we have employee transitions, as well as just any, like I said, day-to-day activities that need stuff done. So
you help us. We have the Coaches for Charity Martin Luther King Basketball Classic, which is happening in a couple of days on Monday, January 20th at McHale Center. We started early in the morning with a demonstration game from some middle schoolers and elementary school kids, go all the way through to the final game with South Point and Tucson High School men's team starting at about 8 o'clock. And so we go from early in the morning until late at night at the McHale Center. And Mike, you've been a big part of that. How long have you been involved with the Martin Luther King basketball tournament over the years?
I haven't been keeping track, but I think I've only missed one or two throughout the time. And so I know one of the members of the committee, Andy Morales, mentioned that we're about to participate in the 21st endeavor of this basketball event on Martin Luther King Day. And what it comes down to is Herman House, many years ago, was able to kind of reserve McHale, get the ability to rent that out on that Monday holiday, and convinced Tucson high school teams to go ahead and move one of their home games to play in McHale that day. And it's grown over the years. I want to say early on we had 5 games maybe. Mm-hmm. So it basically kicked off usually early afternoon, and then we tried to create a pretty marquee matchup later in the evening. And then, like you were saying, this year it starts out with a elementary and middle school exhibition at 8 a.m. And actually runs to that last game, which, if everything stays on schedule, tips off at 7:30. Unfortunately, usually our schedule's a little tight and we run a little late, but it's a fun day. It's an opportunity for young kids to play in an arena that, you know, definitely dwarfs the high school arenas that they play in, and get an opportunity to, you know, play in front of some people maybe that don't necessarily follow high school sports and go on campus at the high schools and can come and watch them at a more central location at McHale.
Yeah, most of those students who play high school basketball here in Tucson, and we do this also with the Kickoff Classic for football and do a special bowl-like experience for those students. But we do this MLK Classic. I would say 99% of them will not be playing Division I elite basketball like the 12 or 15 players that the U of A has on their team right now, both men's and women's. And, you know, we've had some few. We've had Sean Elliott and Fat Lever from ASU and some others that have played on McHale's floor representing a team. Some kids from Tucson have played on NAU and played on some other teams. But to be on McHale's floor is certainly a special thing for these students. So we appreciate what you and the athletic department does to allow us to do this. Why do you think it's so special for students? You've been doing this for 2 decades now. Why do you put in the time and effort, and why do you help us do this, and why do you think it's special for students?
Well, like you said, the experience, I mean, I don't know, I kind of think back and it really doesn't seem like I've been doing this as long as I have, and kind of the energy that comes from athletics and sports. I mean, I was a huge sports fan growing up. I obviously didn't play at a very elite level at any level. I didn't play any kind of high school sports or anything like that. But I mean, I've been a sports fan and have watched sports for my entire life. And just seeing anybody be able to kind of dedicate the time, have the discipline to do what they do, to try to get better, to, you know, work as a team, to kind of strive towards that goal. And this particular event, it, like I said, it's, you know, it's a lot of fun to watch as a student worker in the athletic department. Probably about 30 years ago, I remember doing some work and watching a dad and his young son kind of wander into McHale, and they stood at the edge of the court, didn't walk out onto the court, and, you know, looked at me as I walked by, and obviously could tell I was working, and actually asked permission of, you know, this 19-year-old college student that was working there to see if they could go ahead and step out onto the court because of the reverence that they had for the facility and what had gone on there and everything else. And I mean, I think that, like you said, just kind of resonates in the community. Those kids that, you know, follow basketball, we've had the privilege to be able to watch successful basketball teams for decades. And I mean, it resonates not only, you know, with the men's team, but our women's team has had great success as well. And to see, you know, young girls kind of build and establish themselves in high school basketball and get that ability to come out and play. I mean, in a lot of cases over the years, I'd say of this event, some of the girls' games have been the most dramatic, back and forth, down to the buzzer, down to the wire, versus, you know, some of the boys' games definitely have been good, but a lot of them have tended to be a little one-sided at times. So,
right. So this event,
those kids have fun and come and play.
So the event is the Martin Luther King Basketball Classic, which will take place on Monday, January 20th, starting at 8 a.m. at McHale Center, all the way through till about 10 p.m. We've got 9 basketball games scheduled with some demonstrations from a couple of high schools with the Chicanos por la Causa. We've got the African-American Museum will be there with a display. Some African-American medical students from Banner will be there. We'll have T-shirts for sale. The cost is $10 for the whole day. So if you come and buy a ticket early in the morning, you can stay all throughout the day. And there's T-shirts for sale for $10, and we've got a program for $3. And so concession stands will be open on the east side, and it's just a great day to get involved and celebrate. Oh, by the way, parking in the Cherry Garage, parking on the streets is free on MLK Day, so you don't have to pay, and you can get into the Cherry Garage as well for free, and those gates will be open, and you can use that garage too. So, Mike, I just want to thank you and the athletic department and all you do for the MLK Classic and Coaches for Charity. We look forward to a successful event coming up in a couple of days. And thank you for all the efforts that you do to support student athletes in Tucson.
I appreciate that. Thank you. And I'd love to see anybody and everybody that can come on out and
Great.
Yell loud, cheer loud, and just support some young kids trying to get better and enjoy the game of basketball.
Great. Thank you. Mike Hargrove from the University of Arizona Athletic Department. We'll be back after the break. Welcome back to Jump in Tucson. I am your host, Dr. Ed Ackerley. This is the Monday Wonder Show, where we talk about the wonderful things happening at the University of Arizona. With me in studio is my executive assistant, Morgan Murphy. Good morning, Morgan.
Good morning, Dr. Ackerley.
We're going to flip the chairs around here, and you're going to ask a couple of questions, because for those people that know, I teach at the U of A, so you start, and I'll start answering questions for you.
Yeah, so actually, I want to know, how long have you been a teacher at the U of A?
At the U of A, I've been about, it's been about 35 years. I've been affiliated with the Eller College and a career track position now. About 32 years. I did start early on in the College of Fine Arts in the radio and TV department and taught some adjunct classes there before I got started over at Eller. But I've been at Eller for over 30 years.
That's awesome. And I know I always say you're my favorite teacher.
Thank you.
And
I can change grades up to 2 years afterwards. So.
Well, I think there's a reason for that. We've been talking about it a little bit, and I know you prepare a lot for your classes. They mean a lot to you. So I just wanted to know, what is it like preparing as a teacher for a new semester?
Well, I think in the 300 and 400 level classes I teach at the Eller College specifically, I also teach over in SBS in the communications department, and Kelly Neely and other people I get come in, General Ted Maxwell and so forth, Grant Kruger, to come in and speak to my classes. But I would say one of the things that I do that's different than maybe some of the other teachers is I do bring a lot of guest speakers in from the outside, and coordinating those, it's kind of like getting the guests for Jump in Tucson. It's kind of a giant jigsaw puzzle, and trying to invite people to come in and then coordinate that, and things come up and they can't come, and so you got to shuffle the deck. It takes a lot of effort to coordinate that. And also, you know, I come into the classroom every single day prepared to know exactly what's going to be happening for the 75 minutes I'm with the students. And I do tell people on a regular basis that it's kind of funny. I drive down Speedway and I'm talking on my phone and, you know, talking business and all the things. I pull into the Park Avenue garage. I tell the person I've got to go teach. And so I hang up and I get out of my Tahoe and I start walking towards the elevator, and I say to myself, what class am I teaching? What's the subject today? What are we going to be talking about? But because I've done that preparation in advance, I can pretty much wing it. But, you know, I prepare the PowerPoint decks in advance, and I teach with what's something I call edutainment, which is in a way to try to engage the students and get them excited about their own education.
Yeah, that's awesome. I got to say, as a student, sometimes I have those, a lot of times I have those moments too where I get out of the car and I go, I've even walked into the wrong classroom before. I mean, it gets stressful. You know, you have so many tests, so many different classes, so many things going on. You have life outside of it. So what are some tips you would give to college students to stay on top of those assignments, maybe not walk into the wrong classroom?
Right. Well, you know, that's a good thing. You know, when I talk to young people, especially parents who share with me, you know, their concerns for their student who's maybe had a challenging high school experience, or they've had a rough couple of years leading into their business degree and their marketing degree. When I talk with students and their parents about what they can do, I say, you just got to be engaged. Mm-hmm. You have to turn on a switch and say, every day I walk into the classroom, I'm going to be engaged. I'm going to listen. I'm going to take away one thing each day that makes me a better student, better person, better son, daughter, makes me a better friend, makes me a better spouse or whatever I'm going to be down my life, better employee. And if you get engaged in the process, it's just like the Marines or religion or politics or anything. You get proportionally out of something what you put into it. And if students are engaged, and I force them to be engaged in my classes, and I get a lot of kudos at the end of the semester of saying this is one of my favorite classes, it really doesn't have a lot to do with me per se. I'm delivering the content. It has to do with the student flipping a switch in their own lives and becoming excited about their own education, and that's really important.
Yeah, one of the reasons your class was one of my favorites was because something you said was, because, you know, you can sit and complain, I pay so much and I don't enjoy this and I hate that. But something you said was, well, you're paying to be here, you know,
right.
So you might as well get everything out of it that you can. And that actually, that flipped a major switch in my educational journey. You can see it in my grades, actually.
Right. I can also say that I think it's important for students to engage with their professors. You know, it's the
it's the students that I can remember, 10 years later, know who they are, what their name is, what their goals are in life. And those are students that have engaged with me and tried to have me help them with the trajectory of their own personal career. And those students that get involved with their instructors and take advantage of the resources that are available are the ones that get the most out of their education. So I really encourage that. I also, as you know, I'm a stickler for thank you notes. Mm-hmm. When someone invests in a student's education, I think it's really important that they get a thank you note from that student. And that's a practice they should continue on throughout their whole business and personal life.
That's something I've tried to learn. You know, emails are great, you know, they're awesome, but they get flooded in the emails, and a personal note with your own handwriting and your own stories, it sticks with people a lot more.
It's a little bit of a lost art, and so we try to get them to do business practices that will stick with them for the rest of their life.
So what is one of the best ways for students to fully take advantage of their education that they are paying for?
I would say coming to class and be engaged in the process, and be willing to ask a question, even if you think it might not be the best question in the world. Ask it. Get your homework done in advance. Don't be the people that are turning in homework 10 seconds before the D2L folder closes. Do it the night before. Do it the week before. Stay on top of all of your classes. It's time management. You know what I call college? I call it the education. The education that we're giving is kindergarten for life. Mm-hmm. We're teaching you how to not only get a master a subject that is important and will make you some money down the line, but we're also teaching you business practices and life skill practices that are important for you to kind of exhibit that your interest in what you're doing. And if I can get students engaged in that process and make them do that, then I think, I make them call me Dr. Ackerley. I make them attend class. I give them rules. But I also want them to break the rules and be excited about their own education and see what they can do on their own.
Yeah, and just being there, you make connections, whether it be with peers or even just how you said connecting with your professors. Like the opportunity that I have here today was because I made a connection with you, versus if I was some random student that emailed you, that might not have happened, you know, because
right.
We've had those conversations, and those are important every day, even to show up to the class sessions outside to get extra tutoring. That's also making a connection. And then being there, you meet your peers who can also get you amazing opportunities later on down the line or become best friends later on.
Right.
So connections are everything as well, especially in the Eller Business College.
Yes.
Yeah. That's something they teach us a lot about.
Right.
Are there any goals for the next semester?
Well, I'm the utility infielder, I call it. I take on classes when there's transition. We have a couple of people on sabbatical. We have some people, health situations and so forth. And so the dean and the department chair ask me from time to time to take on classes. So this semester I teach a sales management class, learning how to manage salespeople. But today, I start the process of developing a curriculum for another class, which is sales communication. And so I've taught it before, but it's been about 6-8 years ago. So I got to redo the whole entire syllabus and make it relevant for 2025. And so to have that class be really meaningful in people's lives, I teach a total of 5 classes at the university over the course of the year. And that's, each semester. And that's a lot for a career track faculty member. But I put everything I can into it, and I want the students to leave thinking that they, I got a couple of ovations this past semester from my students. I'm not doing it for the ovations. I'm doing it to get them excited about their own education and get them to take something away that's going to be meaningful.
And what do you always say, what do you teach?
I teach students. That's what I teach. So.
Yeah.
Well, coming up on Tuesday, we have Ted Maxwell, on Wednesday, Grant Kruger, and on Thursday, Tom Moulton. I'll be back on Friday with business success stories. If you'd like to be on Jump in Tucson, give Morgan a call and we can get you up. Jump in Tucson broadcast from the Bustos Media Studios at KVOI 1030 AM radio. Thank you for listening. We appreciate you, Morgan, and all you're doing for Jump in Tucson
Thank
and
you.
Your education at the University of Arizona. Thank you, Matt Neely, for all you do to keep me on my toes. And can't believe it's been over a year now that we've been on the air. It's fantastic.
Congratulations.
Thank you so much. Thank you for listening. I hope that you will jump in Tucson.